few aliyot of Parashat Dvarim contain an extensive discussion of Israel's contact with other nations that they encounter on their way to Eretz Canaan. Specifically, we hear about Edom, Moab, and Bnei Ammon. And the Torah teaches, or Moshe in his speech, describes how all these three nations, who are all descendants of Avraham Avinu, Moab and Ammon are descendants of Lot, and Edom, of course, is Esav, descendants of Esav. All these three nations received their portions in the eastern bank of the Jordan River and Eber HaYarden, and they replaced earlier peoples. And each one of them, there was an earlier people which is described. Just to show you, the Torah in Perek Bet, Pasuk Bet through Hey, says the following. God said to me, Moshe speaking, saying, Rav lachem sovet ahar hazeh. You know, it's enough that you circling around this mountain, the mountain of Hal Seir, which is the mountain which belongs to Edom, which they are not allowed to enter. Go to the north. The north, of course, is into the land which is now modern-day Jordan, at that time we called it Ever HaYarden. You're passing by the boundary of your brethren Bnei Esav, who live in Seir. Seir is the name of the highlands where the Edomites rule. Right? And they will be frightened of you, and you need to be very careful. Al tidgaru bav, right? Don't instigate anything with them. You don't even get one footprint worth of their land. Why? Because it's been given as an inheritance to Esav. Similarly, a little bit later on, we read, do not besiege Moab. Do not instigate war with him. It's been given to the children of Lot. Al is the name of the city in Moab. And therefore, that is also not available to you. Don't start up with them because you will not succeed. This land does not belong to you. And finally, it was Bnei Ammon, a little later, Vakaravta et mul Bnei Ammon, Al titzurem v'al titgar behem, ki lo ten meretz Bnei Ammon lecha Yerusha. Right, don't, same thing, don't start up with them, don't besiege them, because I won't give you from the land of Bnei Ammon as an inheritance either, ki livnei lot et atiyah Yerusha, because it's an inheritance or it's a possession of the children of Lot. Now, attached to all three of these peoples and their rights to the land in Eber HaYarden, we hear about how they received that land, which of course was by conquest, and each one conquered it from a different people. Right? So it says here about the Moabim, the Moabim ha'emim lefanim yashvu ba am gadol v'rav v'ram ka'anakim. People named the Emim, who were apparently giant, they're very large. Rifaim Mechash, they considered to be giants. Of him, Anakim. The Moabim, we call them Emim. The Moabim called them Emim, perhaps from the word Ema, meaning terror. So they were terrifying. But the Moabim, nevertheless, displaced them and took over the control of the land of Moab. Additionally, we hear about Esau, v'Seir shvo achorim lefanim, right? The original inhabitants of Seir were the people named the Chorim. Bnei Asuf yirashum, and Bnei Esav took possession from them. Vayashmidu mifneihem, they destroyed them. Vayishvu tachtam, and they settled in their place. Asher asa Yisrael le'eretz yirushato asher natan Hashem lahem. And of course, this is all in the context of Israel's future conquest of Eretz Canaan. And this phenomenon of one nation conquering another and displacing them is not an unusual one in human history. And the Torah recounts it, but not only does it recount it, but it seems to be justifying the phenomenon, which is problematic, and we'll return to that point in a moment. but it's certainly saying that the original inhabitants of Ever Eden, of Eretz Moab, or Eretz Bnei Amon, or Eretz Seir, Eretz Edom, were not the children of Abraham. Those original inhabitants were displaced through conquest by the original, by the new peoples of Edom, Moab, and Bnei Edom. The question I want to ask is, what's the point of telling us all this? Why do we need to know about the original inhabitant? Now, the phenomenon of conquest, of one nation replacing another nation in a particular geographical area, is not a new one. It wasn't a new one then. There's nothing particularly unusual about it. Why is Moshe, in his recounting of the history, make such a point to remember for us this particular detail, and each time, for each group? All of this, I think, it sort of adds to the puzzle if we think about the continuation of the story. The story continues, of course, with Moshe going towards, or after they pass by Bnei Amon, they go towards Eretz Sichon, right? Sichon is the king of the Amorim, of the Amorites. And in that situation, what does Hashem say? Hashem doesn't say, you know, avoid them, or don't start up with them. In fact, he says quite the opposite. He says, Hachel Rash, right? Go begin taking possession. This is now, these people, the Amorim, are now people for whom you're going to need to conquer, and that's okay, that's fine. The situation here is, if you like, one of geopolitics, of who has the right to conquer whom, or who has the right to replace whom, and how does that work? How does the question of possession of the land get itself worked out? Before I sort of address that question, I want to point out another thing which is, I think, significant here. And that is that despite the fact that Moshe was told, Hachel Rash, go take possession, Moshe's first action, and we don't actually see, strictly speaking, we don't see a command from God to do this. The Moshe's action in Dvarim Perek Bet, Pasuk Chavav, is Vayishlach Malachim Yimidbar Kidei Mot El Sichon Melech Cheshbon Divrei Shalom Lemor. And Moshe says that at that point, after God told me, go and, you know, conquer, go and take possession, I sent messengers to Sichon with messengers of peace. Evra v'aratzecha b'derech nelech, let us pass through your land. We'll go only on the way. We won't lo asur yaminu small. We won't digress right or left, and we'll pay for food and for water. You know, just let us pass through. And the precedent, of course, is the Edomim and the Moavim, who allowed us to pass through. And of course, Sichon does not agree. V'lo ava Sichon melech cheshbon pasuk lamet avireinu. He didn't. He was unwilling for us to pass through. Kigsha Hashem elokecha et ruchu, because the Lord your God strengthened, hardened his heart. V'imet et levavo leman in order to place him in your hand as he is this day. And that is, in fact, the setup for the continuation, where, of course, they conquer Sichon, and they conquer Og, and all of the eastern bank of the Jordan becomes part of the inheritance of Bnei Israel. So we have here an interesting phenomenon. We have here a situation where all the peoples of Ever Ha'adim are Bnei Avraham Avinu. They're all replacing the original inhabitants. And the Torah is very insistent on the legitimacy of their possession of these lands. And it's not just the legitimacy of Israel's possession of the land, is the legitimacy of the Edomites' possession of the land, and of the Moabites, and of Bnei Ammon, of the Ammonites, their possession of the land. Not only that, Israel isn't allowed to fight with their cousins slash brothers, whoever it is. Now, this is not a permanent phenomenon, as we're going to see later on in Tanakh. There's continual warfare with Bnei Ammon, with Moab very often, and David HaMelech fights a war against Edom. There's the notion that there's like a Semitic brotherhood going on here is certainly not the case. The children of Abraham fight very often to the extent of a real sort of bloody rivalry between these peoples. This notion of don't mess with the Edomites or with the Moabites or with the Ammonites is particularly in the generation of the conquest of the land, and that's what we need to understand. What exactly is going on here? Let me just point out that Moshe's insistence upon sending messengers of peace to Sichon, you know, to the Amorites, is consistent with the Rambam's position that even in a situation where the Milchemet Mitzvah, right, we're commanded to conquer, like Moshe was commanded to go take possession, that does not preclude the requirement of trying to make peace, as the Rambam and Yilchot Melachim says in Perek Vav. Right, one does not make war with any person in the world until you first call for peace, regardless of whether it's a milchemet reshut, a war, permitted war, or even if it's a milchemet mitzvah, a war of a commanded war. Shneimar ki tikra, because the pasuk later on in Dvarim ki tikra val. And then the Rambam goes on to describe what exactly is the situation, when, how do they make peace, what are the conditions, etc. They have to accept upon themselves not to do a avodah zarah and things like that. But that's not our issue. So Moshe is consistent with that idea, but nevertheless, it seems odd given the fact that God had simply told him go instigate war against Sichon, and that's another thing which we need to address. I think the answer, the explanation for all this, is pretty straightforward. It's not a, it's not anything like very subtle here. The whole story here, the whole description, and sort of short history of the previous nations of the various areas, plus the description of the engagement against Sichon in Moshe's retelling of this story. It's got to do with a basic fact of biblical geopolitics. And that is that history and politics are not, on the most fundamental level, in human hands. It's God who decides which people will be the winner and which people will be the losers, which people will inherit, which people will be disinherited. This is not an idea which is limited to Israel, or the special treatment of Israel, obviously. It's a fundamental idea of the notion that God controls history. Now, we might not see God's hand in history very readily. It might be too complex for us to conceive of. But every so often, we receive insight into this through prophecy. And the most striking example of this is perhaps the Nevuot that we see about Nebuchadnezzar, who is described in the Nevi'im as God's messenger, even though Nebuchadnezzar was obviously not someone we view as a good guy, but he sort of conquered the modern, the ancient Middle East, and he's viewed in a whole series of Nevuot as being God's messenger to punish the various peoples of the area, including eventually the Judeans. The most famous expression of this, even more famous perhaps than the Nevuot, is in the first Rashi in the Torah. So Rashi very famously asks the question, why does the Torah have to start with the Breshit? Why does it start with creation? It should start with the Mitzvot. It should start from HaChodesh HaZeh Lechem Rosh Chodeshim. That's the first Mitzvah. And why is he beginning with this long and convoluted story of creation and Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, etc.? And Rashi's answer is, Mishum koch ma'asav higid navol atet lehem nachalat goyim. It's a pasuk in Tehillim. Right? The power of his actions, he tells to his people to give them the inheritance of the nation. So then he elaborates, She'im yoru amot ha'olam Yisrael listim atem. If the nations say that you're thieves, She'kevashtem arzot shiva agoyim, that you conquered the land of the seven nations, Hem omrim lachem kol ha'aretz shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You have an answer. The whole land, the whole world belongs to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hu b'ra'a, that's why, of course, Breshit is first. He created it. And gave it to whoever is right in his eyes. And according to his will, he gave it to them. And according to his will, he took it from them and gave it to us. And we saw this later on in Brit Ben Aftarim, when Avram is told that Ger Yezaracha Veretz Lo Lehem, and it's going to have to wait until your descendants are going to inherit the land. Why? Ki lo shalem avon ha'emori. Because the iniquity of the Emori, of the Amorites, isn't completely full yet. The Amorites have not sinned enough in order for me to take them away from their land, but God, looking into the future, is sure that it's going to happen. The other side of that idea, in terms of you take away from one and you give to the other, is also part of the divine plan or the divine manipulation of history. If you recall, Avram was promised in Brit Milah to be an Av Hamon Goyim, right? So Avram's God keeps his promise to Avram in Ever Yarden. Right, his descendants, not just Israel, but Edom and Moab and Bnei Ammon are a multitude of nations, and Avram is their forefather, and they all receive, if you like, their inheritance, and God therefore is emphasizing, or Moshe is emphasizing to us, that is a legitimate thing. It's legitimate for them to own that land, because it was given to them by God in exactly the same way that God has given the land of Canaan to you, to Bnei Israel. And that, of course, is also fulfillment of the same promise, right? This is in Bereshit Perek Yudchet, and I will fulfill my covenant between you and me, speaking to Abraham and to your descendants, to be God for you and for your descendants, and I will give to you and your descendants the land of your dwelling, and that's you, Avram, that kol eretz Canaan, all of the land of Canaan, la'achuzas ulam, for a permanent portion, ve'iti lehem le'elohim, and I will be a God for them. In other words, the reception or the inheritance of Eretz Canaan is a direct expression of God's will and of God's providence, which extends not merely to Israel, but to other nations as well. So what do we get out of all this? I think that there's two different perspectives here, and it's important to distinguish between them. There's the divine perspective, and there's the human perspective. Whereas from the divine perspective, what are the considerations or the criteria by which God determines who gets what portion? So there's two sides to that, I think. First of all, there's the moral side, right? Lo shalem avon ha'emori. In other words, the nation loses his portion because of moral corruption, right? Eventually, the Amorites and the Canaanites are so corrupt that God essentially removes them from history. Finally, the other side of it is, of course, is that that's God's decision. The question of who has the right to direct such a disinheritance, and when is it legitimate? Well, it's only legitimate when God organizes it. And in a certain sense, human beings, it's not their job to be in charge of that. How do we see that? We see that in Moshe's action. Moshe is, despite being told that the Amorite kingdoms are ripe for the plucking, right? They're going to conquer them, and God's going to help you, and go take possession, Hachel Rash, Moshe sends peace messengers. He's saying, if your guys are willing to accept the conditions of, you know, ceasing the Avodah Zarah, and whatever it is according to the Rambam, we will not conquer you, and we will live with you in peace. Because the requirement of human beings is to strive for peace, and to not strive for conquest and for making war. And not, don't worry, God, if it's going to happen, God will arrange for it to happen, as he did indeed with Sichon, where he hardened his heart and encouraged him to, you know, to fight against Bnei Israel, and eventually they were destroyed according to God's plan, that the evil, the iniquitous, in the end are going to lose their inheritance and be replaced by people who hopefully will succeed in keeping it. Of course, every inheritance, whether it's the Israel's inheritance of Eretz Canaan or any other nation's inheritance of their land, is dependent on their behavior. The only difference is that Israel has this permanent arrangement between God and Am Yisrael, that despite the fact that they can lose their land, and they did on more than one occasion, that loss is temporary, and there's a permanent breach between them and God, that they can always come back, and they always have an opportunity to return, which doesn't seem to be the case with other nations who receive their inheritance, but their inheritance is has a potential for being taken and not returned, and they disappear from the pages of history, something which doesn't happen to Am Yisrael. Shabbat Shalom.